ahead and get started. My name is Hannah Riley Bowles. I'm Research Director here at the Women in Public Policy Program, where we are dedicated to eliminating gender gaps in political and economic participation, health, and education. I want to pause for a moment and welcome back some of the fellows who were here years ago from the International Women's Forum. We're honored to have you here. And sap your power. It's really great. Thank you. So I have the honor of introducing today Tali Mendelberg, who is a professor of politics and at Princeton University. Her research is on both race and gender, and she investigates how institutional interventions can reduce gender gaps. And today she's going to talk about the silent sex, gender deliberation, and institutions.
Great. Thank you so much, and thank you all for coming. This is the first time that I've had a chance to present my work to a room consisting of so many women, so I'm looking forward to that experience. So this is a large project, a long time in the making, and it's yielded and now beginning to yield more publications, which I've listed here. A lot of what I'm talking about today is going to be coming out in a book with Chris Karpowitz next year with Princeton University Press. So let me start with an illustrative example to motivate this project. By the chuckles in the room, I gather that many of you have already seen this photo. It appeared in January on the front page of the New York Times and created a huge stir, a negative stir, because this image of all men in the inner circle in the White House evokes just a patent sense of unfairness, just a patent sense that by their physical absence, women are also absent in terms of representation. So no bodies equals no voice is the equation here. Well, so the next day or so, this is what appeared. And now the claim, at least implicitly, is that having women's bodies physically present in the room is naturally going to alter their representation, not just of whatever special or specific experiences women bring to the table, but perhaps a general ethic of care is going to find its way into the discussion and naturally into public policy. And what I want to do is to complicate that assumption and to ask, what difference does it make how many women are in fact present? But also, going well beyond that, what difference does it make how these people are interacting? And my argument is that the nature of the interaction makes a huge amount of difference and can either amplify women's substantive representation, that is, the kinds of concerns that they articulate and their ability to influence the decision-making. It can amplify or considerably mute that ability of women to find substantive representation. So the procedures and rules that govern the interaction, how this meeting is run, is going to turn out to make a huge difference. So that's what the project's about. And I'm broadly addressing these two research questions. How does gender composition increase women's participation and influence in a discussion? So this is just the sheer physical presence of women in the room. And do particular procedures that an institution, an organization follows, does how the meeting is run matter? And we're going to look specifically at the decision rule. What rule is the group using to reach its decision? Because that decision rule is going to turn out to have huge consequences for the nature of the interaction between the individuals present at this meeting. And just again to cut to the chase here, our findings are that low descriptive representation, that is, having very few women present, does not always decrease women's ability to articulate their perspectives and to influence the decision making. So low numbers do not necessarily lead to a very low level of symbolic representation, because the decision rule can help ameliorate the problem. But also, high descriptive representation does not always increase women's symbolic and substantive representation. That is, numbers by themselves are not enough. And so our bottom line conclusion is that we need to fit the decision rule to the numbers, or if we can, fit the numbers to the rule. Okay, I'm going to skip over this because I've got a lot to cover. I think this group is naturally already inclined to understand why gender might be important. For other audiences, I have to dwell for some time on the slide. I think I can skip over this. And so the framework of this project, broadly speaking, is how the social and institutional context of a group discussion, whether it's a meeting or other type of deliberation, how does that context affect the level of gender inequality between men and women during the discussion? And by social context, we mean who is present. And by institutional context, we mean how people must act. How are they supposed to reach a decision? Who is allowed to speak when? What are the procedural rules that govern the discussion? And so on. And again, our bottom line is that the effect of who is present depends very much on how people are supposed to interact. And just an overview of our findings, I'm only going to have time to talk about a few of these today, but I've got lots of backup slides, so I'm going to invite you to ask questions about these other things after I'm done with my prepared remarks. So just kind of running through this laundry list of outcomes that we have investigated in this project, we are looking at participation, by which we mean floor time. How much do people speak? How many speaking turns do women take versus men take? We're looking at authority, by which we mean the participants' perception of each other's influence, which we ask after the discussion. Self-efficacy, the perception that my voice was heard. So a person's own sense of their authority and their effectiveness in the discussion. A satisfaction with the deliberation. The status in the group. How often are women versus men validated by friendly interjections while they're talking? And conversely, how often are they the targets of displays of dominance in which they are negatively or hostilely interrupted? How often are women versus men articulating their own pre-discussion preferences during the discussion? We've got findings on that. How confident, that is certain, are women versus men in the preferences that they leave the discussion with? So do they leave the discussion with a sense that, yes, I know what my preferences are? Or conversely, are they leaving the discussion with a lowered sense of, actually, you know, I'm not quite sure what my preferences are? We take confidence in a person's preferences as another measure of power and authority. And finally, we're also looking at the extent to which women versus men are able to influence the group's decision. So when the group finally does take a vote, how much influence do women have in shaping that decision? And what I'm going to do today is talk about the final piece of it, which is how much do people, again, women versus men, speak about women's distinctive issue priorities? So when it comes to issues indexing care for others, which are women's distinctive priorities, and I'm going to talk about that, how often does the discussion reflect those women's distinctive priorities? So that's what the focus is today. Okay. So our starting point for this particular paper on the agenda in women's distinctive priorities is the fact that normative political theorists have been advocating more deliberation in more areas of society and politics as a key mechanism for enhancing the strength of democracy. And some people, especially empirical researchers, such as people that I tend to talk to, sometimes react to this as, well, this is just pie in the sky. You know, more deliberation, more of the time, sounds like a really nice ideal, but realistically, who's actually trying to do this? Well, it turns out that many governments at all levels are increasingly turning to these efforts to include citizens in more deliberative democratic settings. As well, we also have long-standing practices by civic associations, not just town meetings in New England, but across the country. People meet in neighborhood councils, they meet in homeowners associations, they go to city councils where they may testify. Of course, they take place, participate in jury deliberation, and so on. So there's really a variety of settings, some of them newer, some of them long-standing, where people are, in fact, attempting to engage in actual citizen deliberation. Now, a key attraction of this deliberative democracy ideal model is that, quote, it's supposed to diminish the discriminatory effects of class, race, and gender, according to Amy Gutman and Dennis Thompson. But, of course, there's always a criticism of this, that deliberation may, in fact, exacerbate these social inequalities. So without due attention to actual procedures and mechanisms that can reduce social inequalities, these meetings, these opportunities for people to interact and make decisions together may actually amplify these inequalities. And specifically, through this mechanism of voice, that is, groups that tend to have less authority when they speak in society may refrain from speaking at all, and when they do speak, may not voice their distinctive concerns. So this is our kind of, one of our key concepts is, what are the distinctive concerns that women may want to articulate but shy away from articulating during these discussions? So gender shapes not just the content of views, but also people's proclivity to talk about their views. And this is what is distinctive about gender, we argue. So a key remedy here is, let's raise the low numbers of women in deliberating bodies. And we're seeing a variety of efforts around the globe attempting to increase the number of women present in the room. There is an interesting effort in the state of Iowa, which now requires gender balance when on local boards. So when a person retires from the board, that's when the gender balance edict is supposed to kick in. And officials who appoint members to these boards are supposed to make appointments with regards to gender balance considerations. Then there are a variety of international organizations, the European Union, the United Nations, the Organization of American States, the African Union. They've all urged 30% minimum quotas for women in various political bodies, and over 100 countries have now complied or attempted to comply with that recommendation. So the questions we're asking in this paper are, does increasing women's descriptive representation, that is, elevating the number of women who are present in the room, actually increase their substantive representation? That is, if you have more women in the room, do you then hear more voices for women's distinctive concerns? And are the decisions reached by these bodies more aligned with those distinctive concerns? And can low levels of representation, can those low levels be ameliorated with a decision rule that is minority friendly? And we're specifically looking at a unanimous decision rule, because unanimous decision rules are known in various literatures to be especially good about increasing minority participation, numerical minority participation. So our thinking was, if unanimous decision rules are especially good at including numerical minorities, perhaps they will also be friendly to social identity minorities, such as women. So if every voice counts in unanimous decision rule, perhaps every woman's voice will count under that rule as well. And we're also asking, when does high descriptive representation fail? So we're wondering whether it's always good to have more women in the room. So when you've got a majority of women, are you all set? And our answer is going to be that actually no. Because if you have these strong consensus norms in the group, that may backfire on women when they are not the minority. And the reason for that is there tends to be an asymmetry between the effect of the rule on men and the effect of the rule on women. And I'm going to show you some patterns of results in line with that assertion. So what are some reasons why being surrounded by many women might empower women? One reason is, we know from various studies that in discussions that include a large number of women, there tends to develop a norm of nice interaction, right? So this is a culturally based norm that's been documented all the way back in girls' playgroups, where being nice to each other is a culturally desired norm. And so we might find that, for example, with more positive interjections directed at women when women are talking. And we might find less direct criticism. We might find lower levels of hostility directed at women when they're talking. Also, women seem to feel more comfortable speaking their minds when there is a sort of norm of nice interaction. So that's one possible explanation. Another possible explanation is that when there are many women around, then what that means is there are few people around who seem to be especially confident So not very many overconfident individuals in the discussion. One subpoint related to this is studies have found that politics is still viewed as a man's game. And so it stands to reason that in discussions that look like they're about political matters, women are going to feel less confident than men do and defer to men's apparent expertise. Also, men seem more confident than comparable women in general when it comes to politics. For example, in surveys of candidate pools, people who are who have the profile, the qualifications to run for office, even though the qualifications are the same, women express much lower levels of confidence than men do about their ability to run. So again, if there are many men in the room, it may be that women believe that they simply lack a worthwhile contribution that they can make to the discussion. And finally, and a third potential mechanism is when there are many women in the room, women may be less often interrupted by men, right? So especially if men are socialized to engage in more assertive behavior than women, then men may naturally sort of want to interrupt speakers, whoever they are. And when there are a few men around, there are a few interrupters around. So that may be another possibility. So all of these lead to the prediction that the more women there are, the more that women will voice their distinctive concerns in the discussion. But our key hypothesis is that, again, the number of women present is not the only important factor. And so unanimous rule.
I'm sure. So sorry.
Yeah.
Can you go back? I thought, are all of these go in the same direction, your prediction? So few women feeling.
Yes, so it could be that when there are lots of women around, women speak more about care issues because there's a nice norm of interaction, and so they feel comfortable speaking.
But
that's
if they
one.
Feel less confident?
Then when there are many women around, there are a few other, that is, men around, who are more confident.
Oh, they will feel relative. They will
so
be less likely to be overshadowed.
Right. Women
okay,
will feel
okay,
relatively
sorry,
confident
okay.
because there are a few overconfident people around them.
I didn't try. Okay, sorry.
Exactly.
Forgive me.
No problem. Feel free to ask questions.
You know,
yes.
On that point, and you don't necessarily have to address it now. It may come up later. But when we look at politics, for example, it may be that politics being viewed as a male game, women opt out of that, so to speak, because it's viewed as sort of less nice social interaction. But I'm curious also about the modeling effect, right? Because women can also may predict that they're less likely to be successful in that game because they don't see models which would indicate that that pathway's useful, like McGinn's work looking up above you in your professional context.
That's right. So that would be another possible reason, a modeling effect. And that could actually play out even in a short-term interaction situation. So that's a good point, another possible reason, again, leading to the same prediction. But our major point is that all of these dynamics are going to be qualified by the group's decision rule. Again, as I indicated, our hypothesis is that the unanimous decision rule, if the group uses it, is going to mitigate women's minority status. So all these deleterious consequences that I was just listing to women from being in the minority, we expect are going to be considerably muted if the group is using unanimous decision rule. And conversely, if the group is using a majority decision rule, where you just need a simple majority in order to get your way in the group, then that is going to help women if they are the numerical majority in the group. And so we're expecting the statistical interaction, which I'm going to be showing you, in which the rising numbers of women in the group does in fact increase talk of women's issues, but only if the group is using majority decision rule. And conversely, we find that when the group is assigned to use a unanimous decision rule, then we find increases of women's issues only when women are few. So again, it's the fit between the decision rule and how many women are present that seems to work. Yeah.
Did you find that this holds true in very large bodies like a parliament and also small bodies, like a deliberative board?
We only looked at fairly small bodies. We looked at school boards and we looked at this experimental situation that we've created that I'm about to tell you about. And so the question of size is a very good one.
Yeah.
We're not exactly sure how much this generalizes to large sized bodies. Okay, I'm going to skip over this in the interest of time, but feel free to ask me questions about why previous studies have not looked at this adequately. So I'm just going to jump straight into our study here. And we're using a controlled randomized experiment. It's got a total of 94 groups and 470 people. And we are randomly assigning the two key variables that I've just discussed. How many women are in the group and what the decision rule is that the group has to use to reach its decision. So it's a 6-by-2 design. We've got 6 gender compositions from 0 females to 5 females. And we've got 2 decision rules, unanimous decision rule and majority decision rule. And by the way, unanimous decision rule, just in case you're wondering, is everyone has to decide or else there is no group decision. Everyone has to agree to the proposal or else it's a hung jury, essentially. And it turns out that none of our groups fail to reach a decision, so we don't have to worry about those groups kind of dropping out of the study. Okay, so each person is in only one of these cells. So you're either in a group with 2 women and unanimous rule, or in none of the others, okay? So you're only in one of these. And we did this in 2 different sites. One is a conservative, very socially conservative site in Utah, and the other is in a liberal northeastern community. unnamed. And here's an important point about our participants. We started doing the study with people of various racial and ethnic backgrounds. But what we found in our pilot study is what seemed to be very important differences by race and ethnicity. And so we came to the conclusion that in order to do this study properly for non-whites, we really needed a whole new study where we sampled non-whites and purposely randomly assigned them to these conditions. And since in our communities we didn't have enough non-whites, we decided to just run the study with non-Latino whites. So everything I'm going to say here applies only to non-Latino whites. So here's our experiment. And we modeled this on an experiment that was done and published in a variety of outlets by Froelich and Oppenheimer, who had a very different set of research questions. But we were inspired by their experimental design because we thought it was very good for our purposes. So here's what we do. We invite people into our lab setting, and we first assess a variety of attitudes before anything happens. They're introduced as well to 4 different possible principles of income redistribution. So one possible principle of income redistribution is that you don't redistribute. Whatever a person earns, they get to keep. Essentially, there is no government tax imposed. Everyone keeps what they earn. Another possible principle of income distribution is everyone keeps what they earn, but there is some minimum tax in order to provide a social safety net and make sure that the poor don't become too destitute. There are 2 others that I won't explain, but the bottom line is almost all our groups chose what we in fact have in our society, which is everyone keeps what they earn, but there is enough tax to make sure that there's a minimum guaranteed income below which we don't let the poor fall. And so the whole question then revolved around how generous should that minimum income be? And what I'm going to show you is just how generous to the poor are these groups in their ultimate decisions. So their instructions were, we want you to have a full and open discussion and choose the most just principle of redistribution. And you have to set a minimum guaranteed income. Now that is going to be applied both to your earnings in the experiment, because they're going to be doing a task and earning money, so it's going to apply to their earnings that they take home from the study, but it's also supposed to apply hypothetically to society at large. And that's the part we're really interested in. And we did this in order to really incentivize them to think hard and act according to what they really wanted. And we also wanted for them to think about their views about society at large. So we wanted both of those things at once. After they discuss and reach an agreement, according to their assigned decision rule, then there's a post-treatment, that is a post-discussion assessment of their attitudes, preferences, and so on, and then they do the task, and they get paid and go home.
And just to clarify, sure. This is behind the veil of ignorance.
It is behind the veil of ignorance.
Yet.
That's right. So they don't know what is the task before before they actually get to it. When they're having their discussion, they have no way of guessing whether they're going to be rich or poor in this hypothetical scenario. Okay, so everything is randomly assigned, group composition and decision rule, and we did randomization checks, everything checks out. Again, I'm just going to skip this in the interest of time. Feel free to ask me questions about the research design and the statistical setup. Let me show you one result about participation, and then I'm going to go on to talk in great detail about the distinctive voice part of this. So this is just to give you a taste of the kinds of patterns that we found in the study. So this shows you the average female talk time in the group relative to the average male talk time in the same group. And just as we expected, there is this interaction between the number of women in the group and the group's decision rule. So as you can see here, numbers do help. So as the number of women increases, women participate more and more equally, but only under majority rule. Under unanimous decision rule, if anything, it goes down. So more women doesn't always help women. It only helps women when the decision rule advantages whatever the numerical majority is.
Is that weighted by the mix?
This is the average female divided by the average male in the group, so it's not weighted in any way.
Okay.
And this is controlling on a variety of other factors that could be correlated with being a woman, because that, of course, we cannot randomly assign.
But might women's amount of talk time diminish with more women in the group because their views have already been stated?
That is possible, but notice here the gender asymmetry. So if it was just a rational strategy, that is, why should I bother talking if everybody's already saying what I want? Why then do we see this huge gender imbalance? I mean, here's the line of equality between women and men in the group, this line at one. And there's only one condition in which women even remotely approach that line of equality.
But if you know the decision can't be made without your consent, the amount you need to argue might also diminish because your risk is lower.
That's right. But what we're finding is that this plays out very differently for women than for men. So if it was some sort
right.
of a gender...
It was clearly...
Right.
If
it's some sort of a sort of gender-neutral strategic consideration about, you know, how do I get this group to go along with me? What do I need to do to get the group to go along? Then we wouldn't see any gender asymmetries. But in fact, what we're finding is that women and men are reacting very differently. So when women are a large majority, there's equality. When men are a large majority, there's dominance. So we're finding that the rule has very different consequences for women and for men. And our hypothesis is that's because women and men start out with very different levels of authority. So let me show you a few more things. Okay. I'm talking a lot about women's distinctive concerns, women's voice. What do we mean by that? Well, what we did is go a priori to settings in which there is no interaction and try to find out in such settings what is it that women seem to care about more than men. And it's going to be no surprise to anyone in this room that consistently the answer is care issues or vulnerable populations. So it doesn't matter whether you're looking at individual survey interviews about the nation's most important problem, or whether you're looking at choice of college majors, or whether you're looking at choice of occupations. All of these add up to women caring for children, for the elderly, for the sick, for however you define the vulnerable in society, much more than men care for or care about those populations. And just a little illustration, if you look at the National Election Studies, which is our major data set in political science about public opinion, there's a question there about what is the nation's most important problem. And children rank approximately 10th in women's priority ranking, and they rank last in men's priority ranking. So it's not that men don't care about children, obviously they do, but when they think about what is the collective problem for our society, children just seem to come to mind last for men. And our, yes?
Just a clarifying question. How many people are in the group? Just to know if five women, is it like five out of 10?
It's five people.
The group is five?
The group is five people.
Okay.
Yeah, so the composition,
the gender composition ranges from no women, that is five men, to five women. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes?
So if you had five women, sorry, back to that chart in my mind, you have the one bullet point that was over. Oh, it's four, sorry.
Yeah, sorry. So this is just for the mixed gender groups, because basically we're using the five female groups in some of our analyses as an anchor point, but not in this one. This is just what is happening when men and women are interacting.
I also have a
sure.
I don't think I understand the gender asymmetry. If I just did the linear kind of combination between kind of the majority women and the minority women, I mean, why isn't it for the men the same? Like if we have mostly men, mm-hmm. then men talk more in the majority group. Right. So why is it? I don't see the asymmetry.
Okay. So when women are a large majority, that's four women.
Yes.
Then the ratio is about equal. So it's very close to one.
Oh, yeah, but it's a level thing. I get
just,
that.
Just
it's a level
right.
thing. But the dynamics, I think there's two different things. Men just generally talk more. If I ran a regression, my sense here is just men are just generally talking more. And then there's a second question is, so that's what I'm trying to tease apart.
Uh-huh.
I totally get that there's a level difference, that men generally are more dominant. But I'm just look, you know, you could think of this as a crossover almost, in that it happens for both, that the majority and minority, the majority and unanimous will have the same effect on men and women, but the levels.
The rule has the same effect on men and women. Well, it does in the sense that, in the majority rule condition, it does, in the sense that when men are the minority, the women talk a little bit more than the men do. And when women, and when women are in the minority, the men talk
yes.
more than the women do.
That's
so,
exactly
so that's
what I'm
you're
to say,
you're
yes.
correct. But what I'm saying is the level of
yes.
that is
I'm
hugely different.
Sold on the level.
So
I'm
that's what I mean by asymmetry.
Yes, absolutely.
Under majority
level,
rule.
I think your specific interaction, which is very interesting, I haven't heard
yeah,
before.
Yeah.
It almost seems to apply to both.
Well, yes. So under majority rule, it always hurts the social identity group to be in the minority. That's correct. But the extent to which it hurts women versus men is asymmetrical. Then, the other piece of this is look under unanimous rule. Under unanimous rule, men do better than women no matter what the composition is. So women never get to one or even exceed one. So in that sense, there's this huge asymmetry, not just in degree, but in kind, under unanimous rule. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Do you find that this dynamic changes depending on, I mean, we're talking about different kinds of groups, deliberative groups, but let's talk about advocacy or social advocacy groups. I think there's certain social advocacy topics that are more related to what you call the ethic of care, I think you use that word.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, to some extent the environment, to even a greater extent for animal rights.
So I'm gonna show you some findings from school boards,
okay.
which you would think would be very different because what are they dealing with but children?
Okay.
So I'm gonna show you some findings from that.
That's what
okay.
I'm on my line of thinking,
yeah.
yes.
Okay. So what we're doing here is we're doing a quantitative count of words that are related to the category poor, and here's our dictionary, and here's what it looks like. Oh, excuse me. So in addition to counting words related to poor, we're also counting words related to other vulnerable groups. Children, family, needy was another one. Poor, needy, children, family, and I think that's it. Okay. So here's how it looks in a typical discussion. This is in one of our good groups. This is a group that's good for women. Okay. It's got a lot of women, and it's got majority rule. So here's what the discussion can look like. One woman says, well, you just have a little baby, that's one thing. Try getting, you know, a single mom and two teenagers, or crosstalk. Hi, and my fees are almost $1,000 a year to send my kids to school, you know what I mean? And the discussion then picks up on these topics. So here's a man who then is talking about a child and a kid. And here's the same man, again, talking about baby. So this is what the typical discussion looks like when women have this equal level of power. When they're participating equally with men, the topics that women tend to care more about are introduced more by women and then followed up more by the other participants. And here's, as a contrast, what it looks like in the bad groups for women. So here, a woman is introducing a topic of care. She says, like my brother has Down syndrome. But nobody talks about that. The thread just dies, so nobody picks up on that theme. So this is what we're trying to get at with our counts of words. And in order to validate that the counting is in fact picking up on these kinds of references that we're interested in, we did a separate analysis where we ruled out that these references are used negatively. So they're not used negatively. People are not saying, forget about your brother with Down syndrome. All right, so this is more statistical stuff. I'm happy to go into it later. We're using two different modeling strategies depending on the type of dependent variable that we're looking at. And again, I'm happy to answer questions if you'd like. So here's an initial cut. Here's what it looks like on these care topics. Again, we're talking about references to poor, to children, family, and needy combined. So you can see that as the number of women in the group increases, the frequency of references also increases. So if you've got few women, you have relatively few mentions. If you have a lot of women, you have more mentions. And you can see in our anchor group of all females, there's no difference between that all-female group and these female majority groups under majority rule. Under unanimous rule, it's pretty flat. You don't see much difference. So again, one of our points is, yes, the number of women matters, but under majority rule. And our second point is, even when women are few, the rule can make a big difference, because look at the women under unanimous rule. They're doing pretty well. So having just one woman in the room does not kill women's ability to speak up. The unanimous rule makes up for the disadvantage of the low number. Now we ran two placebo tests, right? So we're expecting to find this pattern only on care topics, but not to find it on, say, financial topics. And we don't find the pattern where we don't expect to see it. And here's another placebo test. We don't expect to find that pattern when we're looking at mentions of rich. For those who want to look at the tables, these are the statistical analyses tables. Our interaction is significant. The number of women matters under majority rule. It's all significant. It doesn't matter what else you're controlling on. You can control for whether the person's liberal. You can control for how many liberals there are. You can control for how many liberals there are under majority rule. You can control for how highly they rank various principles of redistribution. You can control for whether the person wanted a certain principle of redistribution and the majority wanted that too. It doesn't matter what we control on, we get the same pattern. And I can talk more about that if you want.
And if you run the same regression, interacting by number of men?
If
you can't hear all the questions.
Yeah,
my
question was, what if the regression was run by number of, with the interaction majority times number of men?
Okay, so when we do the same thing for men, we get what I'm about to show you in the next couple slides. So first, let's look at women. This is looking now at the ratio of care frequency to financial frequency. So we're looking at how much is the agenda dealing with these women's topics as opposed to what you might think of as masculine topics, or topics that men tend to care about more than women do, which have to do with salary and money and taxes. So again, not a huge surprise. So if we look at the agenda as consisting of how much care talk versus how much financial talk there is, again, you can see a very familiar pattern. As the number of women in the group increases from one or two up to three or four, the ratio of care to financial rises, but only under majority rule. And again, you can see that these majority female groups with majority rule are doing about the same as women without men. So that's, again, a sign of just how powerful these rules and compositions can be. It can totally eliminate whatever disadvantage women may have when they're deliberating with men. Now, back to your question about the men. So when we run a similar set of models for men, here's what we get. Men are affected, but not in the same way that women are. And the only place that men increase their talk of care issues
is where women are the most powerful. Women are the majority, and they're using majority rule. So when women have the power of the decision rule, the men seem to conform to what the women want.
But this is financial, right?
This is the ratio of
care to financial. Sorry.
Yeah.
I see.
Any questions about this so far? Okay. This is for the group as a whole now. And just putting the men and the women together and getting the group average, again, what you can see is the groups that really matter are these majority female groups with unanimous rule. They look a lot like these all-female groups. So again, there are conditions under which women can achieve the same representation that they would have if there were no men around. I'm going to skip over this next couple slides just in the interest of time. It has to do with when do women introduce these care topics into the agenda, but I'm happy to go back and talk about that. So now let's look at what the groups actually decide. Okay, so remember, the big decision we care about here is how generous is this group to the poor, the poorest members in the group, the poorest members in society. How much of a dollar amount are they willing to put on assisting people who are vulnerable in society? Think about this as, what is the minimum guaranteed income below which these groups do not allow people to fall in society? And what we find is, when groups are consisting of majority females, they are more generous. So this is majority female groups. They are more generous, but only under majority rule. There's no effect under unanimous rule. So again, where women are the majority and they have the power, they can shift the group's ultimate decision in a direction more aligned with their prior interests, perspectives, and preferences. And that's controlling on whether the group is majority liberal or not. So it's not just that women happen to be more liberal than men. We're controlling on that. This is just women's preferences having to do with their distinctive priorities. And here's what it looks like in a graph. So again, having more women helps, right? The more women, the higher the generosity, but only under majority rule. Under unanimous rule, it doesn't work. But again, the second point here is unanimous rule does help women when they're a small minority. So being the only woman in the group, again, is not fatal.
Just, I suspect the answer is no, because you would probably talk about it, but I'm just interested in having almost a third category, the whole sort of critical mass question, because, you know, if you imagine having a substantial number of women in the room, say 40%, that don't have the majority to make past decisions in their vein, but that can really affect the deliberation, I wonder if you can speak to that, because I think that's kind of something where...
I can speak to that, because here's your 40% group right here, 2 out of 5. And it does help to have 40 as opposed to 20, right? It helps to have 2 women as opposed to just 1, but not very much. And so the critical mass is the majority. If you have a majority, that's where your critical mass is. But again, it depends on the decision rule. If the decision rule is a decision rule that helps a majority, yes, that's when you get it. It doesn't help you to have a critical mass if the decision rule does not help critical masses of any kind. Okay, so this is one last table that I'm going to show you, where we've been looking at the care to financial balance in the discussion. So that's the ratio of care to financial frequency. And now we're going to see what effect that has on the group's generosity, right? So we want to see when women are, in fact, speaking more about the poor, children, families, and the needy, what happens to the group's decision? And again, we find that the decision rule makes all the difference. So under unanimous rule, nothing. Nothing happens under unanimous rule. You can talk all you want about the poor, the vulnerable, children, families, nothing will happen. But if your group is using majority rule and you have the majority, if women are the majority, not liberals, but women are the majority, talking more about the needs of the poor, children, et cetera, will move the group's generosity up. So, yes.
So, I was thinking about your very early on, the first time we saw those differences, and there was like majority versus unanimous, and it seemed like, if I recall correctly, having 3, which is majority, any group of 5, you're still dipping down, and 4 was the real, hockey stick.
Right.
Effect. And I was wondering if you did any sensitivity analysis, because it was very interesting to me. It wasn't consistent in all your graphs, and it seemed as though this tipping point or fault line
That's right. So you're right that when it comes to whether women speak and how much they talk, what we seem to find as the tipping point is 80%. And
it's not a straight majority.
You've got to have a huge majority of women for women to speak as much as men do. That's right. But when it comes to what is being talked about, is the discussion about the poor, children, etc., you don't need quite 80%. But you do need 60%, so it's still not as low as 40. 40 would be more comfortable, right? Yeah. Okay, so what we find here is when it comes to setting the agenda of the group's discussion and to influence over the group's ultimate decision, the optimal conditions for women's representation are a high number of women, right, high descriptive representation, but with majority rule. We do find that unanimous rule helps women, so unanimous rule does ameliorate some aspects of gender inequality, but it especially helps women when they're in the minority. It does elicit women's distinctive voice when women are few. So again, as I said at the beginning, the lesson is fit the rule to the number. Let me just very quickly, before I close here, let me show you, there was a question about the school boards or a question about other settings. So we decided to try to replicate this with school boards, and there are these very interesting photos online about that school boards post. This woman is the secretary, by the way, so this is an all-male group. And then you've got variation, because there are 14,000 school boards in America. So it's a great place to look at the effects of gender composition, because you've got a lot of 0%, but you also have some 100%. So here's what a 70% female school board looks like. They are dressed differently. That's quite clear. But the point here is that we've got very nice variation to work with. And so we can see what happens when a school board has more women as opposed to less women. And we are interested in this because it's a really tough case for our argument, right? This is, again, a school board is supposed to be dealing with children. But when you really think about it, and when you look at transcripts of board discussions, there's actually not all that much talk about children. There's a lot of talk about financial issues, contracts, salaries, taxes, budgets. It fits with our masculine issue category. And so you might not be surprised then to find that this is the pattern of speaking turns in school board meetings. And we see almost exactly the threshold of 80% before you get to equality. So 80% is what we found in our experiment. 80% female is what you need for equality in school boards, too. Yeah.
Does it matter whether the chair of the school committee is female or male?
That's a great question, and the answer is that mostly it doesn't. It's tough to answer it because whenever the chair is female, you're over in this zone. So there's almost perfect collinearity. So it's tough to disentangle. But from the few cases we have, it doesn't look like it makes a huge difference. Yeah.
So since what you said about school boards, actually that was my thought too, is school boards are very much like a financial issue body. But what about like city councils? Have you looked at those? Because they're also small and actually deal with a greater number of issues.
We thought about it and we tried looking for city council data. It's very hard to find, so we've been lucky that we've had, there's a huge number of board minutes online. And we're worried about selection bias, selection effects, so we want to make sure the ones that are online are not different from the ones that are not online. And that's pretty reassuring that they're not systematically different. With city councils, you don't have the same availability, so it's tough to know. I would not expect things to be much better in city councils, if anything worse. School boards are the one place in America where you actually have a fairly high average female representation, 40% female representation on school boards, which is the highest amount you find out of city councils, which are 20% female, certainly higher than corporate boards, which are also 20% or less. So this is the best we can do in terms of female representation.
And for this, I presume the school boards were all majority rule, or?
Yes, they are all majority rule. So we cannot test our interaction between rule and numbers with this data, but we can validate the half that has to do with majority rule.
But when we talk about the majority versus unanimous, is it actually voting by show of hands or is it by ballot?
Mm.
I just wonder to what extent that might have an influence on.
Yeah, I believe it was secret ballot.
In
the vote was secret ballot.
Not
here. Here, I don't think. In school board. School boards, I don't think they use secret ballots. I think in our experiment they used secret ballot.
Yeah. Most board functions in the United States, it's all part of the public records laws, so that everything has to be public and then the votes are public.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the things we want to do is try to look at who introduces motions that win,
mm-hmm.
And whether it has to do with the percent female or not. Yeah.
I just want to come back to this critical mass issue. It's just fascinating and shocking and depressing that it needs to be 80%. But I wonder whether you have had contact with other researchers in other countries, whether, you know, what variables might determine that level of critical mass, and what sort of level of gender equality in a certain society may lower that. I mean, I'd be very interested in seeing a similar experiment conducted in the Nordic countries, for example.
Yeah. So I think the literature on the effects of women's quotas and the determinants of women's quotas is a bit of a mess. I think there are some valiant efforts to study this question, but there are so many variables when you're trying to compare across countries that it's very tough to reach any kind of clear patterns. And so the bottom line right now from that literature is it all depends. You know, sometimes a society that you predict would have high female representation doesn't. Sometimes it does. Again, for the effects of quotas, sometimes the quotas help, and sometimes they seem to do nothing or even backfire, depending on a whole complex set of variables. So I don't think we have a clear answer about cross-country studies.
Even looking at what are the female topics, I would assume, for example, in Sweden, more men would be interested in talking about child welfare, perhaps, than in the United States. So it would be fascinating to do a comparison.
Yeah, I think that would be. And especially interesting to do some very contrasting case studies. So take, say Sweden on the one hand, and Zimbabwe or something on the other hand. Yeah. Okay. So just to wrap up. So what are we trying to address here? One of the literatures that we are addressing is the literature on deliberative democracy. And as I started out, when I started out the talk, I indicated that there's a very large normative literature that's very sanguine about the possibility of citizen deliberation, and our results make trouble for that assumption. So our bottom line here is, yes, it is a great idea to strengthen democracy by including more opportunities for people to have discussions. If you're a policy maker or a policy designer, it's a great idea to include more citizen input into the policy making process. But the way that this is done makes all the difference. So one of the promises, one of the ideals embodied by deliberative democracy is social equality during the deliberation. And what we're trying to do is unpack the black box of deliberation to show what kinds of dynamics must be in place for that ideal to come about. We also show that it's very hard to bring that ideal about. There's only one point in our graph where that equality is achieved, and that's when women are a very large majority and there is a majority decision rule. So if anything, we're rather skeptical, although we do see some promise in the ideal of deliberative democracy if the circumstances can be implemented to bring social equality about. We also are addressing the political behavior literature, the study of public opinion and voting decisions, the whole study of, what explains the political opinions and behaviors that ordinary people engage in or have. And our study speaks to that by moving beyond self-reports. The study of public opinion is very much anchored in surveys and public opinion polls that ask people to report on their behaviors or to tell us about their attitudes. We're doing a very different kind of enterprise here by looking at what people actually do. So speech is a form of meaningful behavior. It's not just a way to report on attitudes. And by looking at what people are actually doing, we're helping to move the study of political behavior as well. And finally, most fundamentally, we're speaking to the literature on representation and the conditions under which a socially disadvantaged group, that is a group that has less power or authority in society, what are the conditions under which that group can gain representation in a democracy? And what we're doing, again, is unpacking this black box of policymaking through public meetings to try to get at this. And what we're finding is that for all sorts of representation, gender really matters. And the setting for gender inequality really matters. So process, who is speaking or who is prevented from speaking by negative interruptions, whose concerns are discussed, that's what I talked about today. So this process is a very important form of substantive representation. Symbolic, who is viewed with authority, who thinks of themselves as authoritative, who is viewed by others as authoritative. Symbolic representation is also very important. And finally, outcome, who influences decisions. So all three of these are very important aspects of representation that we are looking at by unpacking this black box of deliberation. Okay, let me just, the takeaway, numbers are not enough. You have three women and one man, the three women are quiet. Numbers are not enough. But institutions can help minorities when they are few. Lots of men, but the woman is talking. Okay. Yes?
I know this is an inter-study, and you said it right off the bat, but I feel a little concern and hesitation when you say women and minorities, because you did only test white women. So coming to this question of institutions can aid minorities when few, by which you mean white women.
Yeah, so as I said, we only are looking at white women and white men in the study, and our conclusions can only apply to that population. We're trying to theorize and think about which of these patterns may, in fact, generalize to other types of social identity minorities, whether it has to do with race, class, sexual orientation, or other types, because what we're trying to really explore here is why is it that women are responding in ways that are different from men's in these situations? And what we're getting at here, and I have some more findings that are, you know, evidence for this, what we're finding is it's not about nice interaction. It's not, these patterns are not explained by the extent of niceness in the discussion. What they seem to be explained by is authority. So when a person feels that they have the authority to contribute to the group, that's when they speak up, and that's when they speak to their particular concerns. And we think that process, although it probably has different, you know, twists depending on the particular identity we're talking about, we think that process is probably common to social identity minorities in general. Yeah.
Did you control for age? I wasn't able to read down your list.
Yeah, in the results that I showed you, we don't. But we've run all of this with controls for a variety of demographics. Age, income, education, there are a couple others. And they don't go away. The results may change a little bit, but the fundamental results stay.
Did you have enough disparity or a large enough range in age to?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
We did, yeah.
So I had three kind of question comments related to your, I'm trying to think about what to take away from your unanimous condition.
Yeah.
And one quick thought on it is I wonder whether or not being the minority in a unanimous decision-making context is potentially different for men and women, and related to your point about authority and legitimacy, whether or not, you know, the voice of the majority is conveyed different degree of authority or legitimacy if it's a man or a woman. But related to that is one other, or maybe separately from that, is two questions. So one thing, like how would this apply? I'm trying to think about it. Would you really practically advise unanimous? And then am I reading your data right that unanimous basically doesn't make a difference? It may affect like the distribution of talking time, but it's not affecting the ultimate decision making. So, you know, that's nice that they get to talk more, but it's not clear that for the not, you know, if it's just lovely,
uh-huh.
let's, you know, make sure the little lady has an opportunity to speak.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? And their decision doesn't end up carrying much weight, then does it really
yeah,
matter?
Right.
And would you even practically advise unanimous decision making in any real public policy deliberative context?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Clearly, we're looking at a lot of different forms of representation. Outcome is one of them, and that's clearly very important. But I would argue that there are other aspects of representation that are also very important. Symbolic representation, the level of authority that a group has is very important. It doesn't translate into dollars for people who need dollars, but that's not the only measure of what's important. So a person's sense of capacity and the authority, they're standing in the eyes of the polity and the citizens surrounding them. That level of standing, that authority, is also very important, perhaps even more important than, you know, the actual concrete decisions that a group reaches. And that's part of what we're looking at also. Let me see if I can show you a few of those results, at least, so you can get a sense of what I'm talking about here. So let's see. Okay, so one measure of kind of sense of confidence, sense of authority, sense of I know who I am and what's really important to me is questions about how certain are you about your preferences. And what you can see here is our familiar interactions. So if you have majority rule as opposed to unanimous rule for few female groups, you get a negative effect on certainty, right? So what this means is unanimous rule protects women from the deleterious effects of discussion undermining the validity of their views. So they come out of there thinking, I know what I want. I know what my preferences are, and I'm sure about them. And I would say that's a very important function of what deliberation can do. Here, let's look at some other kinds of outcomes.
Their exit interviewed?
Yeah, this is the post-discussion questionnaire.
So is that regardless of how the decision went?
Yes, regardless of how the decision went. And regardless of their certainty going in. So before the discussion, we ask them, how certain are you? We're controlling on that. So this is the effects of the discussion on how certain are you that what you think is in fact valid and worthy. So this is a very important part of what deliberation does. When we worry about deliberation undermining women's voice, women's authority, women's sense of capacity, this is the kind of thing we should be worried about, is what I would argue.
How about men?
No effects on men. Men are not injured by these interactions, but women can be. Maybe I could show you a couple more things here. Another aspect of representation is, does a person end up arguing against their own preferences during the discussion? And what we find here is, these are the bad groups here. Majority rule with few women. Women are more likely to argue against their own preferences. Men, in fact, benefit. So in these bad groups, the groups where it's few women, majority rule, the women are actually more likely to argue against their preferences. The men are less likely to argue against their preferences. And then look at the good groups. Majority rule with a lot of women takes away the bad effect.
So why would you argue against your own preferences? Social pressure?
That's right. You feel like your views are not worthy. You're not sure that your preferences are legitimate or worth sharing or even the right things to think about. So I would argue this kind of thing is very important for representation. It's symbolic representation. Let's see just a couple more things here.
And just a point of clarification,
yeah.
The preferences are identified going into the discussion in the survey, or is it part of the post?
It's both. We have pre and we have post. Another aspect is perceived influence. So after the discussion, we ask people, who is the most influential member of your group? Here's why it really hurts women not to talk. If you don't talk, you are not perceived as influential. The more you talk, the more influential you're perceived. So again, regardless of whether the group is deciding to allocate more money to people that you think deserve help,
all of these other consequences follow, and those are very important as well. Yeah. Not arguing that this would apply regardless of the racial or ethnic mix in the group. I'm actually saying I have no idea how well it would apply. It may or may not. My suspicion is, my intuition is, that we're going to find very complicated patterns depending on the particular gender race mix. So I'm certainly not arguing that. What I mean by generalizing to minorities is I want to identify the fundamental processes of authority and social identity and then generalize from them. So one way in which we could generalize is to say, in a group, what happens is important in ways that go beyond the specific concrete decision. So these processes by which authority is either reinforced or undermined probably apply to other social identities that have an authority deficit in society. Just exactly how that works, that's what I don't know, and I'd love to find out. So that's what I mean. Let me just show you one other couple of slides here. The interruptions, I've talked about interruptions a number of times, so let me just show you some of those. Here's why I think what's happening is about authority and power, and not about just being nice, okay? So we counted for each person number of negative interruptions, number of positive interruptions. And we're taking the ratio of how many negative interruptions did they get divided by the total number of negative or positive interruptions they received. Does everyone understand that? Okay. And we're finding the predictable pattern that you've come to see over and over again, this X, okay? So if you have more women in the group, you, the individual woman in that group, are not likely to get very many negative interruptions, okay? The ratio of negative to positive is 0.1. You almost never get negatively interrupted when you are interrupted. Here's the really bad situation for women. Almost every time they're interrupted, it's negative. Unanimous rule doesn't make a difference as far as the numbers. So again, more numbers help women under majority rule, and unanimous rule protects minority women. If you're the only woman in the group, you're not going to suffer this hostility, this negativity, if the group is using unanimous rule. Yeah. So the good news is that there are two pathways to improving the situation. If you can engineer bodies, you know, if you can decide how many people of what kind are in the room, which you can sometimes do. When I create my discussion sections, you know, for my lecture course, I have some say in how many women versus men I assemble. So sometimes policymakers can do that. More often than not, you have a certain base rate of women, and you got to work with what you got. So if you don't have a lot of women, as is the case in almost every policy-making context, you're stuck with the rules. And there's only so much that you can do, as you said. So much are you going to get out of having few women and unanimous rule. You're not going to get very generous public policy, okay? So probably not that. But at least these very deleterious processes of symbolic representation you can ameliorate considerably. So at least women are going to walk out of there feeling like, well, some people disagreed with me, but some people agreed with me. As opposed to, gosh, nobody seems to agree with me.
Yeah. That the world we live in is so nuanced. I don't know that this, I mean, I think it's a great study. I don't know that it can be used in a way where it can be relevant for, in a real world context, because we can't, we don't live in a space where we can say, you know, all white women, all white men, that's who's going to be in the room. I mean, it's going to be people of color in the room. There are going to be gay, lesbian, bisexual in the room. There's going to be, so I don't know that we can ever take this and say, I mean, there's a nuanced piece that's missing, I think, that I don't know that we can ever use it on a generalized, in a generalized context and it be relevant.
Yeah.
I just can't see. Maybe we can and I'm not at that space. But I don't know that the general, I think that it's so general, I don't see how it can be used in real world context.
Yeah, no, I definitely take your point. That's a real limitation of these results. What I would say, however, is unfortunately there are lots of contexts in formal policymaking where there are no people of color. So our school board data, over 90% of school boards don't have a single person of color on them. So I would say that's a reflection of just how significant inequality is in terms of representing people of color.
But as to whether
these results apply to any meaningful real world settings, unfortunately I think they do. Certainly there are lots of settings where they won't, but unfortunately there are enough where they do.
It's pretty robotic to complicate your study design, right, by introducing other elements, or is this it?
Yes, I would like to, but I think to really do it well, we'd have to run the study over again and randomly really recruit a large number of both white and non-white people, and there's going to be variation within the non-white category. So we have to recruit enough Latinos, we have to recruit enough African Americans, and that mix is going to take a huge number of groups. So to really do it well requires a whole study in and of itself.
You know, you have a really interesting second finding.
Yeah.
I think in many ways the big takeaway, in addition to what you, the premise, the big takeaway is that male negative interruption is a tactic, as opposed to a cultural formation which can't be turned off and on because it's their speech pattern of how they've learned to speak. And if it's used as a tactic, I think that's a really important piece of information, because then an intervention can be designed to effectively perhaps mitigate its usage and for women to better prepare against it. So I think that's a really interesting, that's a really significant shiftable scenario which almost every woman encounters at some point.
Yeah, I think that's right. So you can take these processes and design interventions that directly attack the process itself, right? A group doesn't have to use unanimous rule to get the benefits. So if part of what's happening is unanimous rule mutes these hostile interruptions, let's attack the hostile interruptions. And there are two ways to do that, right? One is to try to decrease the interrupting behavior, and the other is to teach people to be more resilient when it does happen. And there are interesting autobiographical accounts from very prominent female leaders. Madeleine Albright, I don't know if anybody's read her accounts of her autobiography, but there's this great quote. She says, "I started going to meetings in government, and at first, and I was almost always the only woman in the room, at first I felt like nobody's listening to me, and when I said something, it was ignored. When a man said the same thing, it was picked up on and congratulated, etc." And she said, you know, I had to decide whether I was going to let that get to me or just, you know, overcome it. And it was a learning process for her in which she had to learn to just ignore the hostile dynamics and the ignoring and just speak up more. And there, you know, this is I think, something that many of us have experienced, just learning how to address it when it does happen. So I think there are two paths. One is to affect men's behavior, and the other is to affect women's.
And the interaction.
Yes, that's right.
So I didn't think we'd end this talk with a lean-in message. But, this is fabulous. Thank you. You've really clearly got it.